Hello and welcome to Real Talk. I'm your host, Susan McCabe, here with you every Tuesday at lunchtime to do what I consider seek answers to questions large and small. Today, this is probably the biggest question there is. We are recognizing the 50-year celebration of Earth Day, and I am honored to have with me Dennis Hayes, the executive director of the original Earth Day 50 years ago next April. He's also founder of the Earth Day Network, which is now in 180 nations, and he is president and CEO of Seattle's Bullitt Foundation, which has for at least 20 years been dedicated to safeguarding the natural environment by promoting sustainable communities in the Pacific Northwest. Welcome, Dennis, and thank you so much for being here.
Hi, Susan. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, 50 years ago, you were a whippersnapper, and passionate one at that.
I thought of myself as sort of a whippersnapper. I was actually 25. And, you know, the anti-war activists in that era were 24, 25, 26, 27. During the bus boycott in Birmingham, Martin Luther King was 26. We thought of ourselves as young in our mid-20s. But with the climate strikes currently going on, these are kids that are 12, 13, 15, 16. Mm-hmm. The 18-year-olds are the senior citizens of the student climate strike. I was kind of middle-aged by their terms.
Well, and at that time, what were you thinking? What was the mission in April 22nd, 1970?
There were multiple things, but right at the core is that America and much of the world, maybe most of the world, defined progress in terms of growth of gross domestic product. And in those terms, we had just come through a protracted period post-World War II of spectacular, robust growth. And yet each year, as the gross domestic product got larger, in many ways, the quality of life was getting poorer. We found ourselves in cities from Los Angeles to Gary, Indiana, to Pittsburgh, where if you were simply breathing, it was the equivalent of smoking two packs of cigarettes a day. And that's true if you're 2 or 3 months old, which is kind of disconcerting. And we had rivers that were so polluted that you couldn't swim in them. You couldn't eat the fish that were caught in them if, you know, the Cuyahoga caught on fire. Famously, the previous year, Santa Barbara had a massive oil spill, which brought home to everyone that this was not just a problem of the very poor, that even the quite well-to-do were going to be having environmental problems. And there were just all sorts of things, ranging from the spraying of herbicides all over Southeast Asia to lead as an environmental hazard, both lead in paints, lead in gasoline, lead in water pipes, avian populations collapsing from the use of various pesticides, most notably DDT. And it just sort of all came together. Yeah, the GDP is growing, but this is not the direction we want to go.
At what cost? Yeah. So that was your motivation for starting Earth Day. What did you hope that this Earth Day idea would accomplish?
Well, it's important to remember that in those days, although retrospectively we think of it as having had a civil rights movement and an anti-war movement and a feminist movement and an environmental movement and Chicano movement, that and there were distinct people, and there were some that devoted their totality to one or the other. For the most part, what there was a movement, and it was people who shared values that were antithetical to the directions we were heading in all of those areas. And I would throw in the people concerned about nuclear winter and atmospheric fallout from nuclear testing, the marches that had led up to that in the 1950s. All of that was a contribution toward the sense that we were inheriting a world that was in many ways far more dangerous and far less attractive to live in than the world that our parents had been born into. And the purpose of all of these events across all these different movement sectors was to demand positive change. And so environmentally, within Earth Day, that would mean certainly for a start, cleaning up the air, cleaning up the water, stopping the release of toxins, and what have you. But it was within this broad context that said, "We, that's not sufficient." The Spanish Inquisition took place in a sustainable society that was powered entirely by renewable energy resources. We wanted to have something that was far broader than that, that had within it elements of peace and justice, as well as environmental sustainability.
That's a tall order, and one might say that you've made some real progress. We humans have made some real progress in cleaning up the air in some cities since Earth Day 1970. How do you feel about the progress in general since then that we humans have made in these 50 years?
Well, there's a number of ways to discuss that. In the immediate aftermath, I mean, the first thing to say about Earth Day was its size. The wire services, AP and UPI, looking at the files from the various stringers across the country and adding stuff up, came up with an estimate that 20 million people participated across the country. That would make it the largest planned and organized event in human history. And we were able to capitalize upon that by an interesting thing. That fall, we ran a campaign against 12 incumbent members of Congress. We had many people within the movement who thought that politics was inherently corrupting. They wanted nothing to do with elections. And then we had others that were political organizers saying, yeah, 20 million people in the streets and you're not going to be involved in the election. You're crazy. And the compromise I brooked between the two factions was we would not endorse anyone, but we would oppose the 12 worst. I think it may have been, I'm embarrassed to say, the first totally negative independent expenditure campaign in history. We didn't endorse anything, but by God, we were going to get rid of the dirty dozen.
And did
and
you?
In the end, we defeated 7 out of 12 incumbents, including the chairman of the House Public Works Committee, a guy who, you know, if he wanted to have a road, a bridge, a courthouse, a public building of any kind, a public works in your district, you had to get it through this guy's committee. When he was taken out, clearly on an environmental issue in a primary, I mean, that was like the shot heard around the Capitol. And all of that stuff, coupled with the size of the initial turnout, created a context within which President Nixon felt compelled to set up an EPA that same year.
Yes.
The Congress passed basically unanimously the Clean Air Act of 1970, which has caused certainly well north of $100 trillion of expenditures over the course of the ensuing 50 years. And because of the way that it was set up, they were all with a positive benefit-cost ratio. And we passed the Clean Water Act, and we passed the Endangered Species Act, and passed the Marine Mammal Conservation Act, and the Forest Protection Act, and Superfund. There was a period of about 5 years where we were essentially unstoppable. I think it would not be an exaggeration to say that in terms of long-term cumulative impact on the American economy, it caused money to go in directions that it otherwise would not have flowed as a result of legislation, that it was the greatest change in direction, the only in history, second only to the New Deal. And the New Deal was headed by a hugely popular president coming out of the Great Depression, whereas we were sort of opposed by a somewhat anti-environmental president, but we were fueled entirely by public support.
And so that momentum carried through, you're saying, for at least 5 years.
To some extent, I'd say probably 7 or 8 years. It went well into the Carter administration. It terminated fairly abruptly with the election of Ronald Reagan and the installation of James Watt as the Secretary of Interior and Ann Gorsuch as the head of the EPA. So there clearly was a backlash that came along at some point, but we had upwards of a decade of real progress.
And that backlash seems to be fairly typical of our American culture, from one backlash to another.
Yeah, so, it's the pendulum. Whenever you're in the ascendancy, you sort of have to try to prepare for the fact that it doesn't last. American politics just swings back and forth. My hunch is with the Trump administration, it swung so very far in the anti-environmental direction that the backlash may well be enough to be able to catapult us into an era where we make the necessary investments in deep energy efficiency and renewable energy development and carbon sequestration and sensible agriculture, and actually are able to, as we should have for the last 40 years, taken the leadership position and moving the world into a climate-neutral future. But that is going to be a heroic lift. I mean, we are then going up against the existence of the coal industry, the existence of the oil industry, huge, powerful, rich, and I have to say ruthless industries who will not go down happily. And then petrostates, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Russia, Indonesia, Venezuela. I mean, there's a lot of folks who do not want this to happen. And I think maybe Trump has pulled us over so far that in that backlash we will have the political momentum to carry it.
So
I mean, that's the prayer.
I'm hearing optimism from you based on the behavior of the Trump administration. And are you seeing the potential that we have enough political strength left in our weakened democracy to actually pull this off?
You know, there are all sorts of strange things out there that are under the radar and very that will work against this. And among that array of petrostates was clearly Russia, who meddled pretty deeply in the last election and has shown signs that it's going to meddle in this one. And Mitch McConnell has been enormously resistant to putting federal money into protecting the integrity of the electoral system, so who knows what vulnerabilities may be out there. But in terms of faith in the common sense of the American voter, admittedly, they respond in this pendulum-like fashion and overreact one way and then overreact the other way. But I have, just watching what has happened over time on the climate issue in terms of public sentiment, from initially pretty wide embracing of it, followed by a huge campaign by the Global Climate Coalition, funded by the oil industry, and actually much of industrial America that did not want dramatic, abrupt change, turned it to the point where the public was very skeptical that climate change was happening at all, and a significant majority believing that if it was happening, it was not caused by human activity, but by some natural variation. And then slowly, over the last couple of decades, that has just been overwhelmed by the amount of science that has come along and the lived experience of people with hurricanes and tornadoes and floods and droughts and forest fires and heat waves. You suddenly realize this is not, I mean, when you have 3 1,000-year floods in 1 week, you begin to suspect that this is not normal.
So would you say that we have reached a tipping point both in the current status of the climate and in the current status of people's view of the climate? I mean, it is suddenly the darling of the media. How we have short attention spans. Do you think the weather, the obvious impact of the crisis are going to keep us on top of this enough to make a difference?
I think so, provided that you don't underestimate the impact of the student climate strikers. There's a purity. You know, they are not coming up with deep-seated economic analysis of the relative merits of cap and trade and upstream cap and auction and a carbon tax and whether you're going to be going with photovoltaics and a smart grid. I mean, it's basically saying you're the adults, fix this. And it has a kind of a moral clarity to it. You know, everybody wants to be a hero to their kids. And you certainly do not want to be somebody that isn't doing his part. So you throw that into the mix as well. You put a gigantic Earth Day next spring into it at a time that the Democratic primaries are still ahead of us, and we'll be putting environmental things, and particular climate, front and center before the conventions. And I think there's a chance that all of this will result in a situation where we have a very different president, a very different House of Representatives, and at least a somewhat different Senate, where we do not have a majority that refuses to acknowledge the reality that surrounds them.
In their faces, yes. Well, Hal, tell us more about how you plan to recognize the 50th anniversary of Earth Day.
Well, first I should say that Earth Day, while it is a day, and on April 22nd, we are teaming up with the student strikers, but trying to respond to their pleas that say, we're just kids, where are the adults, by turning out tens of millions of adults to be out there in the streets with them. So it'll be a Wednesday, April 22nd, and that will be the Earth Day itself, and the principal focus will be these large events around the planet. But Earth Day, if you will, as a brand, as a theme, it's become a trite sentiment, make every day Earth Day, but we'd at least like to make the month of April and maybe the protracted part of next spring Earth Day with these environmental issues, and in particular the solutions to the climate crisis, things that come up long enough that it has a lasting impact on the public consciousness. We have to get past what I was reciting earlier, the series of climate tragedies, and have a similar ability for people to recite from the top of their heads, what are the climate solutions? What are the things that each of us ought to be doing? What are the demands that we need to be making of our governmental officials and of our corporations? And which parts of the American economy ought to be going the way that we've been trying to send, for example, the cigarette industry, which, you know, we have a very similar addiction to oil as we have to tobacco. We've not been able to make tobacco illegal, and in fact, our experiences with prohibition suggest that probably isn't going to be a hugely successful strategy with anything that's addictive and relatively inexpensive. But we do need to create a context where if somebody has a choice between an electric vehicle and one that's going to be permanently impoverishing the planet, let's go with the electric one and power it with sustainable resources.
Let's look at it really seriously and realistically. What do you think we can do that will genuinely mitigate the worst potential effects of global warming that are now beginning?
There are two different things. First, if you are digging a hole, the first thing you have to do is stop digging. And in this case, the whole metaphor is pouring more and more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, along with other greenhouse gases, but dominantly carbon dioxide from the combustion of fossil fuels. And that just has to begin to attenuate, and it hasn't. In 2018, the planet poured more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere than it ever has before. Step one is you electrify everything, you don't do that overnight, but over the course of a couple of decades, everything that is currently powered by something else, you power by electricity, and you start obtaining all of that electricity from sources like solar and wind and small-scale hydro and geothermal that don't have negative climate consequences. If you do that to all of your buildings, all of your transportation systems, it may mean a significant substitution of high-speed electrified rail for for airplanes, for example, which means that you're going to be getting the airline industry and the airframe manufacturers opposing that particular part of the initiative. But across the board, you start electrifying everything and getting it from clean sources. The second half of that, too, is you have to start pulling down the CO2 that is already in the atmosphere, mm-hmm. because that has baked in changes that are continue to get worse for some decades into the future, even if we stopped tomorrow. And so that means you have to come up with things that sequester more and more of it into the soil. It means that you have to have, instead of cutting down more trees than you're planting every year, you start planting more trees than you're harvesting. And you turn to agricultural practices that, instead of releasing carbon from the soil, will be long-term sequestering carbon. That has the great advantage that it also gives you far healthier soil and healthier plants that are growing on it.
Is that what is often referred to as regenerative agriculture or permaculture?
Yeah. That's a very important consequence of what is often called permaculture or regenerative agriculture. There are a great many things. We are only in recent years coming to understand the extraordinary complexity of the microbiome and the world's soils. But you know, that soil is rich in things that are of an organic nature, carbon compounds from things that used to be alive and died and decayed or mm-hmm. composted and are now part of the soil. The way that we've been coating our soils with a variety of chemicals, including lethal chemicals, herbicides, and pesticides, have turned much of what was once pretty rich agricultural land into sort of barren stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, to be a little controversial and what might be part of your listening audience, you go out to parts of eastern Washington and Idaho where they're growing potatoes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're growing it in soil that has no nutrition in it. The role of the soil is simply to provide a structure that the plant can grow in, and every year they throw in some more agricultural chemicals and some water that they cart in from some nearby river grow it there. We have to return that soil to the basic fertility that it once had. And so much of the country, the means of cultivation that we have are allowing massive erosion, both air erosion, but particularly water erosion. There was one study some years ago that suggested that the value of topsoil that eroded off of the farms of Iowa was greater than the value of the corn that was produced on those farms.
Mm.
This is just spherically senseless. It makes no sense no matter how you look at it. And we have to create an economic system that does not optimize for those values.
And that's a major issue in our capitalist society. What sort of research or solutions do you have for convincing the dominant powers that be, particularly in the oil and gas industry, that this can work economically to save the planet, or that saving the planet can work economically? Is there any way to convince them of that?
I kind of doubt it. Gas, possibly, because they can think of ways that they can make a transition to a hydrogen economy and use much of their existing transmission and distribution infrastructure to move hydrogen around instead of methane, and that could be part of a truly sustainable solution. But there has been this effort for the last half century to get the oil industry to become an energy industry, and frankly, I'm not too interested in that, and I hate to ever write off things en masse, and I certainly know some people who've worked for oil companies who are splendid people with great values, but if you view them as institutions, the oil industry has been consistently just quite horrible. Whether you're talking about murder squads that they pay for in Latin America or in Nigeria,
mm-hmm.
If you talk about the kinds of exploitative things that are going on in the bituminous sands and the oil shales right now, The extraordinary set of lies that they knowingly promulgated very expensively here and around the world to try to create this, and it's succeeding in creating for a period a sense that this wasn't a real issue. despite the fact that their own senior scientists were some of the earlier people discussing what was actually happening. In the Carter administration, the oil industry in the United States purchased virtually every manufacturer of solar panels, and people were rejoicing, saying the oil industry is becoming an energy industry and they're making a transition and using their profits to take us into the new era. They shut down every one of those solar companies within a year of the time that Ronald Reagan was elected president. So they bought up enterprises purely to shut them down, and they did it with something that was pocket change for them as an industry. So convincing them? No, I'm much more interested in defeating them.
I think that makes a lot more sense when that sort of cunning and insidious techniques have been employed. And those folks are very much in charge globally. It looks to me like a huge battle. What does the Earth Day Network plan to employ to wage that battle?
Pretty much everything that we can. That's to say, we're going to be working with those who share the values now and who can be brought to share them in the years ahead. For the 50th anniversary, if there is something that can be done, we're going to be trying to do it. And some of this will succeed, some of it will not. But we have reached out to virtually every museum in the world. It turns out that the people who attend museums and zoos and aquariums are far greater than the number of people who attend athletic events in the United States, professional athletic events. But they go to museums and zoos and aquariums not just to be entertained, but to learn stuff. So to the extent that we can get all of these folks to be putting on exhibits during this period, we think it's going to be a great chance to get families, adults and the children that they typically take with them on these visits, to be somewhat more aware and somewhat more sophisticatedly aware. This isn't just a bumper strip where you say, yes, it's real, and no, it's not real, but displays that are convincing and leave you walking away having actually acquired important new permanently lodged knowledge. We'll be working at the other extreme with guerrilla artists, street artists, to try to get art up that is funny or that captures your attention or is some place where you don't expect to encounter it. We'll be taking as much advantage as we can of social media. We probably will not be as sophisticated as some of the Russian hackers have been, but we're going to be doing what we can to try to move messages out through Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and
all those
Weibo and all probably will be moving through some that don't even exist today or that do exist, but I'm too old to know about them. but that future generations are really paying enormous attention and getting an astonishing amount of their information from such sources. So we have to be players in that.
That is hopeful. We have 30 seconds left. Dennis Hayes. You've been listening to Real Talk. My guest has been Dennis Hayes, the executive director of the original Earth Day and the man who's preparing to recognize 50 years of devotion to planetary health this April, for April 22nd, the 50th anniversary of Earth Day. Dennis, what can you leave us with? How do you remain hopeful that we can turn this situation around?
My wife, who is clearly the smarter half of our family unit, has made a point on various occasions when I get particularly bleak, and especially if I'm bleak giving a talk to some group, will talk to me afterwards and say, you know, Dennis, what in evolutionary terms is the survival advantage of pessimism? And of course, there is none. Unless you think that you can succeed, then you are doomed to failure. And I think that's something that, although the odds don't look great for us right now, I think you have to cling to that hope.
And to those young people like Greta Thunberg, who stand up to adults and say, hey, do something. Dennis Hayes, we know you've been doing something for 50 years, and I could not be more grateful for the time you've given us to talk about our planet. Thank you so much.
It was my pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you, folks, for listening. This has been Real Talk. I'm Susan McCabe, your host. here with you every Tuesday at lunchtime to seek answers to questions large and small.